This is Spoilers Club. This is our third Spoilers Club. This is the kind of every 2 months show that I do where I bring an author on to talk about their book, but the goal is that we are talking about everything in the book, because I realized when I was thinking about interviewing an author about their book and asking them questions, I realized all the questions I wanted to ask would give the book away. But as a writer, I really wanted to know the answer. And so I set up Spoilers Club, which is I was encouraging you guys to read the book early so that we could all come here and ask questions about it to Ursula, who was kind enough to A, be on the show, and B, call me saying, are we having a show?
For the record, the calling did require an effort of will because, you know, calling is like such, it's almost an aggressive act.
Yes,
now.
I know. That's why I thought that was really weird. Like, Ursula's calling me. Yeah.
So I did text you first, for the record.
Oh. Why am I not getting texts? I've got a damn smartwatch. Why aren't you smarting, smartwatch? Jesus. I don't know. All this damn technology.
We can sort that later.
I'm glaring at my watch like that'll do anything. Anyway. Yes. So, I'm welcoming today my good and dear friend, Ursula Vernon, a.k.a. T. Kingfisher, which is the pseudonym she uses when she writes for adults. Because you started your awesome career as a children's writer and you did not want children to read books like this, and parents often will grab books by authors without actually looking at the absolutely horrifying rabbit being devoured by mushrooms on the cover and would just say, hey,
awesome
Ursula wrote
cover.
A new book. What?
Yes. Isn't that an awesome cover? I am just so happy with that.
It is absolutely gorgeous. I was actually preparing to put it on this overlay. So let me do that. Tell us about, so far what I've done is given away the end. Madeline was dead all along.
When did you give that away?
No, on the other Spoilers Clubs.
Oh, okay.
I just bring it up immediately. Good. So because the first rule of Spoilers Club is you have to spoil.
Yes, the spoiler is that Madeline Usher has been dead this whole time.
Yeah. The embarrassing thing was what I really wanted to do was read Fall of the House of Usher just so I could ask some comparison questions, and I didn't get a chance to do that, so I'm sorry about that. I realized I've never read it.
It's okay. It's short. It is unexpectedly short. My brain thinks it's a novel. I think everyone acts like it's a novel. It's a short story, and I don't think it's even a novelette. It's very short, and the premise is that the unnamed narrator goes to the home of his friend Roderick Usher, who is like freaked out and is sort of, you know, suffered a great disquietment of the nerves, and briefly sees Roderick's twin sister walk by, and Roderick says casually, yeah, that's probably the last time you'll see her because she's dying, and then she dies, and Roderick buries her, and the narrator is like, why don't we get the hell out of Dodge? This place is terrible. It's, you know, falling into the lake, it's covered in mushrooms, this is not healthy. And Roderick's like, nope, can't leave. And so a large portion of the book is spent with them reading poetry to each other and doing paintings at each other. So they paint stuff at each other, and Poe describes the paintings and how, you know, dramatic they are. And then all of a sudden... spoilers for Fall of the House of Usher, which being over a century old, Roderick is like, I can hear everything, oh god, you know, and eventually reveals that he thinks Madeline might have been buried alive, that had been one of Poe's obsessions, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the narrator reading, like, epic poetry or something. Yep, Madeline shows up having been buried alive. Roderick screams, faints, falls down. The narrator screams, runs out of the house. The house collapses into the lake. And that's the entire book. And I, or book story. And I was like, I reread this, you know, a couple years ago, just because I do a lot of like sort of pulp retellings. My last two novels, horror novels, The Hollow Aces and The Twisted Ones, were based on Algernon Blackwood's The Willows and Arthur Machen's The White People. And I was like, let me read some Poe. And having read Fall of the House of Usher, I was like, okay, this narrator is bullshit. Like, what a useless friend. You scream and fall down. Does he even stop to check anyone for a pulse? No. Roderick screams and falls down. Madeline falls down. No checking for pulses. Just lunges out of the house. And then the house collapses. Which, okay, granted, he got out of the house before it collapsed. But I feel like you should have at least tried to drag somebody out, checked for a pulse, something. You could. There were so many things he could have done that were not read epic poetry and do paintings at Roderick. And so, also the whole book is mushrooms. There's just wall-to-wall fungus. Like, you start out and it's all fungal emanations. They spend way more time on fungus than they do on Madeline. Madeline has no speaking parts. And
of course
I was
not.
Like,
she's a woman.
Yeah, if I was gonna do a retelling of this, obviously it's the mushrooms who are responsible for Madeline's illness. Obviously something's up with Madeline. Let me start writing and see what happens. And do you ever have a book like once in a million years that's easy? Like it just kind of flows?
Maybe.
Like I've had
stories like that. I don't know if I can say I had a book like that, but I've had stories like that. Yeah,
this is a novella, so it's a glorified story. Most books, I mean, you basically chisel out of the space in your chest in individual blocks, but once in a million years you get one that's just like whoosh, and this one went because. As soon as I started writing, the narrator, Easton, showed up on the page, and it was so much fun. When you're writing in first person, or when I'm writing in first person anyway, part of what I'm doing is sort of being the narrator, and it's just so much fun being Easton. Like, Easton is just, it is a delight to be in their head.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, I mean, they're sort of the late
hey Ursula
19th century. Yeah,
can you do the magic mic switch again?
Yeah, let me try. How's that? Am I better?
Oh, not this time. Uh-oh.
All right.
Oh wait, now it's better. Guys, we're having weird issues with
okay,
the microphone, so you're good now.
Okay. I had to switch and then switch back, apparently. Because that's just how things go.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, anyway, it was just so much fun being Easton. Because they're this, you know, 19th century military... they're not a dude, but they're kind of a bro.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Easton just wants to be Easton. That's what I get. It's
yeah.
Like you try to put Easton into any sort of box. They're just like, I'm a soldier. What the hell else do you want from me?
Yeah, and they're just fun. Because, I mean, they're not feckless exactly. They're great in a crisis. But they're the sort of person who has the story about the time they were thrown out of a bar at, you know, 3 a.m. after having picked a fight with the bouncer. It's just, they were so much fun to be. And so, yeah, Easton, as soon as they were on the page, they just tore off and kind of dragged me after them. And it was easy to get the words down, With the exception of the bit where, after about 15,000 words, I read the book Mexican Gothic by Sylvia Moreno Garcia and was like, oh, somebody's already done a Gothic with fungus, and there's nothing I can do that will compare to this, so forget this book. And I might have abandoned it completely, except that Nightfire was like, give us something we can, we would like to buy a novella from you, or a book from you, or multiple books from you. And I was like, I too would like this thing. And they were all, and this is a phone call. I haven't written it yet, because, you know, even if you have the idea, a Gothic with mushrooms, two writers will come up with two wildly different takes. Okay. But you should go read Mexican Gothic, because it's fabulous.
Yes, we had something happen with the connection, because tonight just is going to be awesome.
Oh dear.
I don't even know
where
if
did
still
I cut out?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay,
just
good. So you and I are still technically on a call. Stream is back. Thank you, Cheryl. Okay. Yeah, it said I lost network, and then I was about to text you, but then our call came back, and you were still talking like nothing had ever happened, and I'm like, what? Am I the only one seeing this?
What I'm looking at this moment is the soundboard so that I can click the thing over when it starts to go.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and because of Windows something-something, Ursula can't even see my camera unless she looks at Twitch, so it's not like our video anyway. Anyway, yeah, so if you missed what she said, it's actually in the author's note in the back of the book, all the stuff about Moreno Garcia, and Mexican Gothic and stuff. And I'm really glad you wrote this. One thing that I always found funny about Poe is that I just kept thinking, man, it would have been awesome to write around the time where you could just make up any sort of shit and not have anybody call you on it. Because I remember when I read The Pit and the Pendulum, I'm like, wait, he just lays there while the blade comes closer and closer, and then the literal cavalry show up? What? Yep. I couldn't get away with that.
I loved that. As a kid, I had those leather-bound collections, mm-hmm. you know, of great writers that your relatives give you for Christmas when they know you like to read, but mm-hmm. they don't know anything else about you. And I had Poe and Jack London and Charles Dickens and Arthur Conan Doyle. And Dickens, I am afraid, got pretty short shrift, but and Mark Twain. And I loved Poe, and I loved The Pit and the Pendulum. It's the sort of thing that kids eat up. It's very visceral. It's very immediate. It's, you know, it's creepy. And who cares that, yeah, the end is literally he's fallen in the pit, and right as he's falling, the cavalry officer grabs his arm. I mm-hmm. mean, yeah, it's, yeah, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we tried this now, the editor would like go and find a pair of glasses just so they could give us a disappointed look over the top of the rims.
It's like, you know, it's all very visceral, and I was scared and everything, and then it's like, was there a deadline? Did you just have to just scrap the last 20 pages and write, oh, and then the cavalry grabs him, yay! So what you said about the end of Fall of the House of Usher, it kind of tracks. It's like, oh, let's have our very gothic, deep, scary moment here, and then, oh, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
You know what? I was listening.
I'm gonna run away, and the house is gonna collapse. Yeah.
When you were saying that, I was thinking, well, you didn't have the epic poetry or the painting. I'm like, oh, you totally did. You had battle songs and drinking, and then you had the woman who paints the mushrooms. So,
I guess sort of, but no, I scrapped most of that. The only thing I kept was Roderick does still play the piano.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like, yeah, it didn't add anything. I know Poe was getting paid by the word in those, and I just feel like he was kind of milking it a little. Which, you know, I respect the hustle. Probably the power bill was due. These things happen.
Yeah.
Wait, this would have been before power bills.
Probably.
The coal bill was due.
So, one thing that's it's really funny, this is the second book we've done on Spoilers Club with non-hetero, non-cis situation in a time where there were no words for that. And Lily, yes. We did Lily Lanoff's One for All. Am I right, guys? Is it One for All? I keep mixing it. I think it is One for All. Anyway, it's the retelling of The Three Musketeers with girls and chronically ill protagonist, but also there's an asexual character and lesbian characters and a bisexual character, and they're not words for, I don't think, any of those back then. And so, and there also weren't words for what the main character was suffering from. And so we talked about how it was to that. And you have an exposition, I think, in chapter 3 about essentially saying your character is non-binary and serves in the military. And you had to be very careful with laying that out without using any of the words that we use today. Although you did have your own pronouns. So how did you approach that?
You're
buzzing again.
Damn it.
I know. I think we're cursed tonight.
Am I better now?
Not quite.
Okay. Usually takes how about now?
No. This is just...
Okay.
There we go.
All right. Okay. We're good. Okay.
Carry on.
So, the central content, which is, I'm sure you all know because you've hopefully read the book. Otherwise, the Spoilers Club is we've spoiled terrible things. I used basically made up a third gender, which the soldiers in the completely fake small European country that Easton is from are use different pronouns and. This was essentially a loophole for women to stop being considered women and to become soldiers and to, like, if you were assigned female at birth, you could just swear as a soldier and here's your new set of pronouns, here's your rifle, you know. And there's actually precedent, sort of. Which is, there are a couple of cultures, and the most significant one is in, or at least the one that I did, not the most significant, that's the wrong term, the one that figured most significantly in my research was Albania, and some areas, similar areas up in the Caucasus, where you, basically, they had a law that women could not hold property. And this was a problem, but they also had very sort of elaborate clan and inheritance laws, and who could and someone had to be the head of the household, and it was all, you know, very complicated. And the end result was that if you were a woman and you married a guy and then he died, you would have to go live with his in-laws because you could not have your own household as a woman.
I mean, your in-laws.
Not, right, your in-laws.
Yes.
You couldn't go back and live with your family because, yeah, they were done. You had to go live with his family, which was about as appealing as it sounds for a lot of women. But somewhere in there, somebody was like, okay, so the primary problem is that women, it is that only men can hold property. Okay, why don't we just make it possible to become a man then? So, in a very practical move, they developed a cultural system whereby you could just swear, you could become a sworn man. And that was, you took an oath, and from that moment on, you were a dude. And you, which meant, among other things, that because they also had a very strong culture related to blood feuds, that you counted the same as a dude. If somebody killed you, your blood price cost as much as a man, which was more than if you were a woman and got killed because, yay, patriarchy. But also it meant that in practical terms, what happened a lot was mothers who were newly widowed asking their daughters to swear to become men so that the daughter, who would now be a son, would set up their own household and their mom wouldn't have to go live with the in-laws. And it was this marvelously complicated ass system to fix a what was perceived as a cultural immutable, namely women can't hold property. And I love how human a response that is. And so thinking of that and a lot of other things involving, you know, the complexities of pronouns and words and languages, I came up with the idea, you know, what if you had a system where the problem is that only, you know, men can be soldiers, but we could just change the definition of who gets to be a soldier, and so that anybody could swear and get the essential rank and the pronouns of a soldier, and that would change things up. And which is not at all what happens in Albania. They do not in any way consider this to be a third sex. You are a dude. You are absolutely a dude. There's no question you are a dude. But that was part of sort of the springboard for some of my thinking about human solutions to these problems of gender that we have created and these weird cultural workarounds. And I started thinking about, you know, this Galatian culture and their cultural workaround, which resulted in, you know, Easton. And also all tied up in there was a lot of women I knew in my youth in the days before they would let women serve in combat roles who were really pissed about it. Mm-hmm. And who wanted to be fighter pilots and things. And so, you know, for them and out of all of this reading and sort of muddling around I was doing in my head, I came up with the idea of the sort of the soldier gender, as it were. And that's Easton. And Easton is not so much strongly non-binary as sort of apathetic. Mm-hmm. In that Easton does not want to be female because it seems like a lot of work. Being a dude is fine, probably, but it also kind of seems like work. Being a soldier is really what Easton is good at. It's what they did professionally. Mm-hmm. It's just who they are. And I know a fair number of people whose gender expression I would classify as apathetic, and they would too. Mm-hmm. So there was some of that in there. And with all of that muddled together, yeah, out came Easton. And yes, it is difficult to do an info dump about the linguistics and pronouns early enough in a 40,000 word novella to get it out of the way. My editor and I did some tinkering there.
Yeah. Well, it went well. And it's also entertaining in that Ursula way of there are two kinds of people who want to ask me about being a sworn soldier, and one of them is the kind of person that asks you everything. And I believe right there I was thinking, well, Ursula's just describing herself there.
It's possible that I was describing myself.
Yes, the kind of person that goes, wow, you do that? What's that like? Oh, you're a vintner? Let me ask you what that's like. And yeah, that's you. And also, here's an interesting thing. I'm going to change direction here. Because
go for it.
This is another how well I know the author moment. Because you really made this damn parasite sympathetic. Even as Easton was thinking, this is hell. We have to kill the hell out of this. It's awful. It's terrifying. It's horrifying. If I get infected, they will burn the hell out of me. They better. You're still making this poor thing that has learned how to see and talk using the dead bodies of mammals as sympathetic, and as they're killing the leg, I'm like, aww.
Honestly, yeah, and part of that was that I was like, aww.
Yes.
And I was actually on another podcast a while back where if this was a science fiction story, we would 100% be rooting for the scientist who is trying to save the fungus against the military types who want to kill it.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's all framing. And in another technological era, possibly I could have found a way to save the Tarn. But in this one, I think that what they did was maybe not the moral or ethical thing, but it was the only possible thing, because, oh God, that would have gone real bad real quick.
Well, considering that it didn't, it totally thought, no, this time I won't kill the host. Come here, let me infect you. It'll be fine. It's hard to trust that, you know?
And I actually had a slightly longer bit that we had to cut for length because we were trying to keep it a novella.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ursula. Can you do the microphone thing again? The chat is wondering whether it's Poe's curse or...
Am I better?
Yes.
Okay.
If it's Poe's curse or if it's mushroom spores in your mic, they're wondering which. But carry on, the longer bit that
possible.
You cut.
Yeah, actually had Denton and Easton basically sitting in the bar going, you know, if we were priests and were concerned about original sin, we have just killed a blameless innocent. And them being like, yeah. But on the other hand, as soon as it got around people, things would have gone really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I part of that is I think of you know how chatbots, they did the one experiment, they tried to have an AI chatbot on Twitter, and if you interacted with it, it was like, you can teach it how to learn things. And it was Twitter, and within, you know, a month, it became a raging, racist, Nazi piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And because people are terrible. And I am actually very much an optimist about humans for the most part, but I don't think that we can, as a in large groups, be trusted with extremely powerful, extremely innocent things. And I didn't see any solution for the Tarn, and I saw a whole lot of terrible, terrible things happening. So, yes, even as I was like, I wish there was a way they could save this, because this is kind of sad, at the same time, no, they really had to kill it with fire.
Yeah. Literally.
Or sulfur, in this case.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So...
Which, there's a line in a book called How Much for Just a Planet by the great John M. Ford, which was a Star Trek novel, where they're watching the movie Fall of the House of Usher, and the character is like, yeah, well, it sinks into the dark tarn, actually, but there's never a tarn around when you need one. And I was thinking of that.
So the character of Denton seems to be there for Easton to be expository at and irritated at. And their relationship was just so good, because you could tell that Denton wanted to know what was in the pants and what was in the bed, but at least was too polite to actually ask, and worked really hard to respect them without stepping outside the lines too much. But that was, I kept waiting for Denton to do something terrible, and I was glad that he tried really hard to learn fast. And how did you build that relationship?
I mean, how many of us, when have either suddenly a friend has come out as trans and you're like, I need to figure out how to not be a raging asshole, but also I have questions.
Yeah.
And I suppose on the other side, how many people have been the trans friend going, okay, are they going to say something horrible?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very easy relationship to write, in so much as there is so much, like, from life,
yeah,
on that I could draw on. I had a lot of fun with the fact that Denton is is American, and it was so nice to be able to write Easton being sarcastic about Americans. That
yeah.
was just hilariously fun, because I mean, I'm an American, so I get to say these things.
Yes.
And Easton also has a couple things to say about the British, but and some about the French, I think, but mostly Americans.
Mostly
and,
Americans and British. I just loved how, you know, Easton was just kept expecting Denton to go and shake the hand of anything he possibly could.
Yes. Yes. In fact, I'm working on the sequel, another novella, and which may wind up being the third one rather than the second one. I haven't quite worked out the thing. And Easton winds up in America because Denton has asked him to, or asked them to come visit. I wrote the damn character. I know better, and I still occasionally default to he because my brain is so wired as part of my society. So yes, sorry, figment of my imagination, for misgendering you. Also, in my defense, as Easton themselves says, they mind a lot less being mistaken for a dude because no one tries to keep you out of the mycology society or whatever. Mm-hmm. But and it's just wall to wall. This novella, the sequel, is just handshaking. Just yes, and then they shook our hands. And then there was more handshaking. And then we were at the hotel, and the waiter did not shake our hands, but I was worried. And I'm not going to have any fingerprints left after this trip because everyone keeps shaking my hand. So, yeah.
Yeah. In chat, Shauna says, Ursula, I misgender myself. It happens.
Oh, good.
Dr. Vinka, PhD, says, is the next book also a Poe retelling?
No, I'm torn because if it's the one I thought was the second book, it's not really a retelling of anything, but there are sort of Shoggoth-like creatures, quasi-Lovecraft, except they're not, and they're not Shoggoths, they're something else. But that one is starting to look like it might want to be the third book. And if so, then I'm also doing a Lovecraft story for the second one, but it's The Shunned House, which is a weird-ass vampire ghost thing, and which has the sort of unusual quality in a Lovecraft story in that the protagonists do something intelligent, which is, rather than stand around just, you know, hurling adjectives at it, they're like, we've found a giant vampire buried under the floor. I bet if we take a lot of sulfuric acid and dump it down this hole, that'll end the problem.
Yeah.
And I do admire that.
So, going back to the point of Spoilers Club, I want to know what is going in, if you can tell us. So you say you had an idea for book two. It may have to be book three and something else be book two. What's happening there? And you may need to switch your mic in a minute. I'm not sure. You were just starting to get a little crackly. And Preemie, I'll get to your question in a minute.
Am I any better now?
Not quite yet. But sometimes it takes a second.
Okay.
Yep, you're good now. I do not know what happening, but
I have
whatever.
No explanation for any of that. Yes, the Little Orange Cat, I appreciate that you brought me a stuffed toy, but we don't need to be so loud about it while I'm on a call. Sorry, the cat carries stuffed animals around and wants to yowl while she does it.
Yes.
It's part of it is how much time has elapsed between things. So when I started writing the Shoggoth one that I thought was book two, it had been like a year, and that was fine. And but it kept feeling a little bit like it was more than that. And Denton had, you know, gone home and whatnot to America, and then the other one that I sort of started vaguely on a lark. It feels like the memory of the Usher house is a lot newer and more raw, and it involves Miss Potter showing up again.
Yay!
And talking about mushrooms, and so it just kind of feels more like book two chronologically. Also, I won't swear that part of that isn't the fact that whichever it is, a novella of some sort is due in November, and I'm a little bogged down on the one, and the other one's just flowing, so I'm like, maybe this one's to be book two.
Yeah. Yeah. Premi wants to know, did you get a lot of input on the cover? It's a splendidly creepy cover.
I got virtually no input, except they showed me the cover artist and were like, we're thinking her. And I was like, yes. And that is Christina Mrozek. And we're thinking something with mushrooms and rabbits. And I was like, yes, I like this thing. Do that. And then they just showed me the finished cover. And I was like, please give me the artist contact information so that I may buy the original, please. And yes. I really need to get that frame.
Excellent, you do. So if you have any questions on how Ursula built this fantastically creepy little book, please let us know in chat.
I didn't think it was that creepy. I thought it was a fun romp with mushrooms.
It was a fun romp with mushrooms until they opened the bunny's lungs.
Okay, yeah, that was a little unsettling. Which, it's funny that that's the point where you found that unsettling, because other than, like, the dead rabbit, like, you know, being, once they've shot him and it's still looking back is, or walking around is the creepy bit, but,
Yeah,
the lungs were unsettling.
I guess, you know, you're reading what you know is horror, and it's, if you've read horror before, there's stuff you understand as horror, and there's stuff that actually affects you. And so, you know, weird stuff that if I saw actually happening would freak me the hell out, of course. I'm like, okay, cool. Well, I knew about the smart mushrooms and the driving the little bunnies like a bus, and so yeah, that's happening. But then when they actually start to dissect it, and they find out that they open the lungs and then starts to move. Yeah, that gets all the... Yeah, that's where I started to go, ugh. Yeah.
Yay! I always find that so interesting, the points that people think are creepy, because they're almost never the points that I think were creepy.
Mm-hmm.
There are books that I have written that there is one thing that, like, will creep a bunch of readers out, and I'm like, I almost didn't put that in because I thought it was too hokey. All right, then.
Shauna says, you are very bad at seeing what is actually creepy. And Premi says, I slept with the lights on for weeks after the Twisted Ones.
Aww.
Daniel wants to know, how much knowledge in mycology did you have before writing this book?
Probably slightly more than a normal person. Just because I'm me and I'm like that. But...
This is true.
I collect tidbits of information that are interesting. As far as a general understanding of mycology, certainly not the sort where I get a degree in it or anything, but I happen to have access to some lovely people on Twitter, who Tillicat was certainly extremely helpful, who were like, okay, if you want to make a fake brain out of mushrooms, then what you need is something to sort of simulate the folds of the brain. And so it's actually all done with fungal sheets over a macro algae, and that carries electrical impulses. And like, we worked it out practically how the tarn worked. And I was very pleased with that. It's just the problem is that the 19th century sciences don't have words for any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, they knew what macroalgae was. And so even though I knew how it worked, I knew they wouldn't or they couldn't describe it. So there was a lot of... I think it might almost look more hand-wavy than it really was in practice.
Mm-hmm.
But... The big problem was interface, the question of the interface between the fungus and the mammal brain. I mean, it started on fish. There's a couple of weird fish, but any animal with a brain is, I mean, that's going to be really hard. because it's the two systems just don't talk to each other. It's like the scene in Independence Day where they upload a virus into the alien computers. That would, no,
yeah.
Your computer can't talk to their computer. And also you had like 30 seconds. Did you really have time to do the animated GIF of the laughing skull, Jeff Goldblum? Did you really? Not that I'm bitter. So humans, like for the most part, the mushroom can't just take over the brain because it doesn't know what it's doing. When it takes over ants, when the cordyceps fungus takes over ants, and I did a lot of reading about that, but I specifically didn't want to use cordyceps because the girl with all the gifts, spoiler, uses cordyceps, and everybody got very excited about the cordyceps mushroom for a while. And which is a fascinating fungus, don't get me wrong, but it had already been used for zombieing. It takes over the ant, but it doesn't, like, the fungus can't see through the ant's eyes or anything like that. All it is doing is basically whacking a couple of neural impulses to that say, climb up very high and bite something. And so it climbs up as high as it can, and then it bites the stem or leaf it's on, and then the fungus just is, you know, the fruiting body comes out of it, and the fact it wants to get up as high as possible because that spreads the fungus spores more onto the entire ant colony. So it's very clever in that regard, but it's not like it's, you know, pretending to be an ant and wandering around and having conversations with other ants. So,
excuse me, friend ant, what is that? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Or, you know, hello, fellow ant.
Yes.
At the school locker, yeah. Right, so interface is a problem. You can't just, like, and there are plenty of very good horror stories where the mushroom takes over and then the mushroom knows everything the person knows. And that's fine if you want to do that. I am not saying don't do that. I couldn't get away with it in my own brain.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, nope, the mushroom is going to spend a lot of time going, how the hell do eyes work?
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of me is photosensitive, but you've only got these two photosensitive spots, and there's a bag of jelly in front of them. What the hell, man? So, yeah.
Yeah. So I am pretty much done with my questions. If you guys have any more questions, please put them in the chat. It was... Who did the interior illustrations? Because that is wonderful. You did. I thought it was you, but I kept looking for the little UV signature and I couldn't find it.
I did the when you open the book up, the flyleaf, not the fly, you know, that page thing on the inside of the cover. I know the name of it. End papers. There we go.
So.
I did the end papers for that one, and also for Nettle and Bone, and I really got to finish the end papers for Thorn Hedge, which is next summer's novella, which is a fantasy novella and not a horror one.
Right.
Well, I say that with the understanding that there are probably bits in there that people will be like, what the hell, Ursula? And I'll be like,
You mean like the opening of Nettle and Bone?
Like, that was supposed to be a little creepy.
It was.
You
achieved a little bit of creepiness.
Yeah, the thing that threw me about Nettle and Bone is, and I won't say too much about it, the one that weirded a bunch of people out was the thief wheel. And I absolutely thought, I thought the tooth dancer would be creepy for
tooth
some people.
Tooth dancer was that creepy. Problem.
Thank you. And, but the thief wheel, I did not expect. I thought
remind me what the thief wheel was? I remember
that was the thing in the dungeon, or then the catacombs, that was like all of the souls of the dead thieves sort of jammed together, and it was just rolling around.
Oh, yeah!
Yeah. Now, some people thought that was very creepy, and I was like, huh, cool.
Daniel wants to know, how do you write descriptions as well as you do? Do they come out in the first draft, or do you refine them in revisions?
They almost all come out in the first draft. Very rarely do I wind up even changing the first line. It the first draft is where 90% of everything happens. That my edits are usually me going back and trying to be consistent and either tightening things up or adding another scene here and there. But for the most part, I just started writing.
The first page is full of very rich mushroom descriptions and how much they resemble flesh.
Yes, and Poe had a lot of mushroom descriptions leading in, so I thought I should. And then the flesh thing was, since East sort of led into, right, Easton's a soldier. Oh, hey, I bet Easton is a sworn soldier, because that's a thing I've been wanting to put in a book for a while. And Easton has kind of taken over and has tinnitus. Wait, please hold up, Easton. I'm trying to take notes. It's lovely when that happens. It doesn't happen as often as I wish it would.
Mm-hmm.
But, I just kind of barf the stuff out, and, if it's good, yay me. And if not, hopefully the editors make me take it out.
Yeah.
This is why I don't teach workshops, because, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah. I understand. Easton mentions their language has 7 pronoun sets. Male, female, soldier, child / clergy, inanimate objects, and God. What's the 7th?
I think it's animals. No, the 7th would be, did I say it was rocks? I think it's probably animals, but it might be rocks.
I'm looking at that page right now.
I invented the damn pronouns, and the copy editor wrote up a consistent sheet on it and went through and pointed out all the places I was wrong.
I was wondering about that. You owe your copy editor a drink, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I so do. Yes, they were like, I've just made a cheat sheet here. Now, do we want to use, this? Or do we want to add an S? What do we, is this a possessive? Yeah, they were, thank God, they were on the ball.
Yeah, actually, as much complaining as we do offline of copy editors sometimes, you really need to, give this one a medal and buy them a drink, because that had to be tough.
Oh, yeah, no, and a good copy editor, and 9/10 of the time they're good, is just sprinkling magic correction dust on everything and makes it better. The only time that we complain is when you get the really weird ones.
Yeah.
And I've had like one or two really weird ones. But for the most part, they are heroic.
Yes.
And almost invisible, because, certainly the reader comes afterwards and just assumes the writer did it all right the first time. Which is a filthy lie. I couldn't keep my own damn pronouns that I made up straight.
Yeah. All right, well, the audio sounds good. We're still streaming, and we actually made it happen, so I think we should quit on a high note.
All right.
Ursula and chat, I am so sorry again that I messed up tonight, but it's been a lot lately, and Ursula, tell us where we can find you online, please.
Red Wombat Studio contains links to all of my books, including What Moves the Dead, and places you can buy them. I certainly hope you have read it already, or else this has been a lot of spoilers, but maybe
spoilers
you're one
club.
Of those people who like to read the end of the book first, which I may do. I know. Look, once I start to actually care about the characters, I have to check the end to make sure none of one I like dies.
Yeah.
I am on Twitter as Ursula V. That's URSULAV. And Yeah, I think that's most of it.
Great. And I am Mer Lafferty. I stream usually weekday afternoons, Monday through Thursday. Monday is noon and Tuesday through Thursday is 3 p.m. This week I will not be doing that because Worldcon's coming up and I need to prepare for that. But starting September after Labor Day, get back into my regular schedule. And you can find out more about me at merverse.com. And we are going to raid Cypher of Tyr. So the raid call is Mer Raid. Thank you so much, Ursula, for your patience and your friendship and your awesome, awesome book. Tune in to I Should Be Writing in 2 weeks when we'll give away the copies that I bought and need to get Ursula to sign.
I will do this thing.
Yes, you will do this thing. Excellent. So, everyone take care. Have a good rest of your weekend. And, yeah, thank you very much again. We'll see you next time.